Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who may not know me, I'm Senator Russell Trude, and I think I'm here largely because I'm one of the co-chairs of the Parliamentary Library Committee, and I've been asked just to chair this meeting, this seminar, vital questions seminar for the library on today. And as you all know, it's on the vital issue of Afghanistan. It's difficult to think that there could be a more important issue to be discussing on this particular day in the Parliament, when of course the House is discussing debating Afghanistan, and as I understand it, the Senate will be doing that next week. And of course there are, in relation to Afghanistan, numerous permutations as to what we ought to be doing there, whether we should be there in the first place, and how soon it should be, if at all, that we should be leaving Afghanistan. But there are at least two relatively clear positions on the matter, and I think I'm inclined to use the word protagonists, but perhaps that's not quite the appropriate term. But we have today two very distinguished speakers whom I think, without having discussed the contents of their remarks with them, will present rather different perspectives on Afghanistan and presumably Australia's position on the matter. And they haven't drawn lots as to who's go first, but in the nature of all good debates, they have agreed as to who'll go first. And Major General retired Jim Mullen has agreed to speak first, and he will be followed by Geoffrey Barker. For those of you who may not know, I can't believe there's anybody in this room, Jim, who doesn't know at least something about you. But let me just briefly outline Jim's very impressive CV. He was for 40 years a member of the Australian Army. He served in a large range of deployments overseas: Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, East Timor, Malaysia, Germany, and the US were probably the easiest of them. But also, of course, he served with great distinction in Iraq as the coalition's chief of operations, and he was decorated for that activity. He is also an author. In fact, but my notes here, I'm not sure who prepared these, but he's a double bestseller author. Is that
right? Well, I prepared those.
You prepared those. a best-selling author would be fine. He's a double best-selling author. I think that's what happens when you go into a second print of your book, which is must have been, and he's now online as well. That's his book, Running the War in Iraq. He now teaches operational art at the Australian Defence College. That's the art of war, I suspect, rather than painting. He's the director of the St. James Ethics Centre. He's an honorary colonel in the Australian Army Aviation Corps, and he is a member of the Order of Australia. In fact, it's been recognised twice in respect to that. There are few people who have the kind of experience of Army combat operations than and Major General Mullen, and it's a great delight to welcome him here this afternoon to speak to us on Afghanistan. Jim.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Senator. I understand I've got 20 minutes to talk to you, and which is not much time on such a subject such as this. But this photo up here, in fact, is not Simpson on the donkey. It's entitled, as many of you may know, Remnants of an Army. And it was painted by someone called Elizabeth Butler. I have no idea who she was. But it depicts the last man to survive the retreat from Kabul, 90 miles through the winter, down to outside the walls of the fort at Jalalabad. The image really itself has been consistently used to illustrate how silly any concept that we might have, any idea we might have to conduct military operations in Afghanistan, and that we are in fact flying in the face of history. Afghanistan, as we all know, is the graveyard of empires. But of course, there are a lot of errors with that. It wasn't an army of 16,000. It was a group of 16,000, of which only a quarter were in the military. Even less were highly trained British troops. One portion of them, the large majority of them, died because of the weather, and the Major General who commanded the entire activity gave a very, very bad name to Major Generals for the rest of history because it was an appallingly run activity. So it was not the high point of British colonial military achievement, to say the least. So, but can we learn from this that there are some constants, such as don't ever conduct military operations in Afghanistan? It might surprise us all to learn, it surprised me, that a punitive expedition recaptured Kabul in the same year. This was 1842. Early in 1843, the British recaptured the Sindh area and kept Afghanistan quiet for 30 years. If we could keep Afghanistan quiet for 30 years, I think we'd be very, very happy. The Second Afghan War followed at the end of that 30 years. It was won by the British in the Battle of Kandahar in 1880. Afghan resistance was subdued. Afghan was reduced virtually to the status of a British protectorate until it was given its independence in about 1919. Is it the graveyard of empires, and are we flying in the face of history? Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to be here and an honour to be here with everything that's going on outside. This debate is important. I hope I can provide something to you in the manner of background. It's a serious issue, life, death, the existence and fate of nations. We heard two tremendous speeches yesterday, two powerful speeches, and there's more to come and more going on at the moment. There's not much more that I can say after that period of time, after what the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition have said, but in the 20 minutes I'll try and do two things. The first thing is I will state my position on what we've been asked to talk about. On the big questions. The second thing is I'll address as many of the issues that tend to derail any discussion on Afghanistan as I can get through until my time runs out. And you might have heard of Godwin's Law, which states that as an online debate grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Hitler or the Nazis approaches one. Well, a similar rule applies to Afghanistan, in my view. In any debate on Afghanistan, you will find some or all of these derailing issues present. I've only got 20 minutes, so I've got to go fast to get through as many as I can, and you can have a hack at me afterwards in the question and answer time. Before I start, let me make some comments about certainty. No one knows for certain what's going to happen in Afghanistan. Absolutely no one. War is about probability. The more you do, the more you prepare, the better your probability of achieving something that looks vaguely like success. But there are absolutely no guarantees. I will try not to say we will definitely win, this or that will definitely happen, and if I do, please forgive me and interpret it along the lines of, in my judgment, I believe that, because that's all it is. And judgment is informed by experience. I interpret Afghanistan through a prism of civil and military operational experience that the Senator was talking about, but most relevant is my experience in Iraq. I haven't visited Afghanistan recently, not conducted military operations there. I can be criticised for this, but that's probably better than interpreting what's happening in Afghanistan through no military or conflict experience or no knowledge of the country. So much is judgment. And judgments is based on experience, and you are quite right to judge us on our experience. Some people tend to give greater credence to our opponents and those that transmit their messages because they think that this is a David and Goliath situation. Big US NATO versus poor little Taliban. All that I really ask is that you apply equal scepticism. Don't believe a thing that I say, but also, when you hear something that's come from the Taliban or even come from the BBC, I would be very, very sceptical of it. So without flogging a dead horse, let me go through some of the very big issues. Why did we become involved in Afghanistan? Sometimes I couldn't care less, I gotta say. We all know the answer to it, 9/11, Al-Qaeda, ANZUS Alliance, etc. And it's of great interest to historians, But in a lot of the blogs I'm involved in, a lot of the discussions I get involved in, we always go back to this central point, and no one ever moves on to say, so what? The fact is that we are now in a war, and all that I ask is that we give equal weight to how that war is run as we give to why we got into the war. Why are we there now, is the second question. Well, very quickly, humanitarian reasons, and most of these were covered yesterday by both the leaders. Humanitarian reasons, we can do good. Alliance reasons, they're quite legitimate. Self-interest, such as regional stability and removing at least one safe haven. And of course, the last reason I put is that because invariably it's harder to leave a commitment like this than it is to not get involved in it in the first place. Can the war be won? The Afghans will win or lose this war sometime in the next 10 or 20 years. We can't win it for them. That's pretty well understood. Success for we, the interventionist forces, is to give some breathing space to the Afghans to decide on their own future. Now, I've never met a soldier who said, we'll make all this work. We will do everything. I have heard a lot of others make some pretty silly statements, particularly early on in Iraq, about what we were going to do. We'll be successful at the tactical level. If we are successful and if we win at the tactical level, we will give some breathing space for the Afghans to be successful to win at the strategic level. The best we can really get is about that, and we have been saying that to my personal knowledge since 2004 in the war that we've been fighting. So this could be one of the greatest of the straw men that are set up and then bowled over. What could happen if we lost? Well, there must be a humanitarian consequence. 10% of people from the last poll that I saw in Afghanistan support the Taliban. 30% of the Pashtuns support the Taliban. There must be humanitarian consequences for a precipitate withdrawal. Regional stability, there must be consequences for regional stability if we go. Having put ourselves there, and you can make your own decisions on whether we should be there and the righteousness of all of that, but if we go, there's got to be consequences, and that's what we manage now. We can't change history. Self-interest, if we lose, it's possible that there will be some impact, unspecified, on the ability of terrorists to mount attacks from the safe haven that was created by the fact that we live. I'm not going to sink or swim on that particular point because it's very hard to make, but there's a probability that that will be the case. And certainly you would imagine that it would embolden extremists throughout the world. How can it be won? Simply, I believe, good leadership, good plan, adequately resourcing the war. It's not rocket science. Everyone has known it, and it's been said in 1,000 different ways, but we consistently fail to do the last one. We consistently fail to resource any war, and then we express surprise when we don't do well. We tend to express strategy in terms of troop numbers, and those troops can come from either foreign or local sources. Foreign troops are normally relatively reliable troops and competent troops. Local troops in a traumatised country normally take years to produce. And this concept that all you need to do is train them to be better than the Taliban is not true in any way, shape or form. And that will guarantee defeat for that force once we go. There are 28 million people in Afghanistan, roughly, and they need about 500,000 troops, 500,000 security force people in the average historically based situation. Iraq now, much the same population, has gone from a very small military, after we defeated their very big military, a very small military to 618,000 security force members. 618,000. Now, there may be a causal relationship between that and the drop in violence. I'm prepared to suggest that there may be a relationship. How long will it take? Both leaders showed great resolve yesterday, and I'm very comfortable, I've got to say, with the 2 to 4 year guide, 2015, on the military aspect of it. If we haven't cracked it in that period of time, if we haven't got significant progress in that period of the time, we're obviously doing something seriously wrong, and we should dump Afghanistan. What is Australia's role and commitment? Well, you heard it yesterday, train the Afghan National Army, support activities as they apply to special forces attacking the enemy, governance and the economy. But the devil is really in the detail, and it's not the doing, it is the outcome. I question the task. Australia's role in Afghanistan is far too narrow. The narrow interpretation of training the Afghan army, which excludes offensive activities, is, I think, highly suspect. It excludes offensive activities by anyone other than the Australian Special Forces, and given where they are being injured and killed at the moment, most of them must be down in North Kandahar. The Taliban, unless we reduce and severely reduce the Taliban threat within the province, then the Afghan National Army is not going to survive. We've been through this once before. We trained another 4th Brigade in northern Iraq in 2004, and it was destroyed. It was destroyed by November of 2004 because we didn't reduce the enemy threat, and we didn't accompany it into battle. At least our brave soldiers are accompanying it into battle. The Special Forces are doing a good job in attacking the enemy and reducing the threat, but there's not enough of them. The commander on the ground says that he has just enough troops for the current role and would find it difficult to do more. I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. To do more, you need more troops. There are many, many functions across Uruzgan which the military should be doing, or which someone should be doing from somewhere, which are just not being done. This wouldn't matter if someone else was out there doing it. We're doing a lot in Afghanistan, in Uruzgan province, but as I say, it's not the doing, it's the outcome. There is no point in training the Afghan National Army if they're going to be destroyed within a very short period after we leave, and perhaps we can talk about how that might work. Even with the functions that I've mentioned that are not being done, the other functions that are not being conducted are protection of the population by an enduring presence. We keep saying we're protecting the population. There's 500,000 Afghans in there. There's a couple of thousand of us. There's a couple of thousand of the Afghans. There is no way we can be protecting the population by having any form of enduring presence. Now, we may get away with this. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to fail. We may get away with it. The question is that the good basis for military planning? Okay. They're the major questions I want to address, and I'm about 15 minutes and I've got about 5 minutes to go. And what I'd like to do is address some of the major issues that derail conversations on Afghanistan. The first one is the graveyard of empires. We've seen the picture up there. We've spoken about the first and the second Afghan war. I would suspect, if I looked at this next slide, I would suspect that Afghanistan may in fact be the single most invaded and occupied country known to mankind. It may not be the graveyard of empires. Some empires passed through it because they kind of missed Afghanistan as they went through it. Others stayed there for a while and committed absolute mayhem. But I mean, I don't know half of those people. I had to look them up to find out where they were. This could be the most invaded and occupied nation on the face of the earth. For 2,500 years, Afghanistan was always the part of somebody else's empire. And of course, we, the interventionist forces, are not trying to occupy the country. We have no desire to occupy the country. Anyone who thinks that we're there to occupy it, I mean, we've all heard the arguments about oil in Iraq. There's no one in the foreign forces would want anything but to go. Okay, that's the first one, the graveyard of empires. We should never impose, the next kind of popular derailer is we should never impose Western values on the Afghans. Well, I don't think we are. We're unlikely to ever effect major changes to Afghan society. I don't have a deep knowledge of their history, but what I have read, I see references to King Amanullah, who instituted Kemalist kinds of models and modernisation, where he instituted monogamy, Western clothing and the abolition of the veil. And that was back in 1928. So it's quite possible that the only people who are trying to impose outside values on Afghanistan are the Taliban. The next point, Pakistan. Now, I guess we all know that Pakistan is the main game. It may not have been the main game when we went there, but it is now the main game. It's a fragile domestic and political situation. Pakistan's non-cooperation, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that we will fail. It just makes it very, very, very hard. And really, if we pulled out now on the basis that Pakistan's making this much, much too hard, it's interesting because I saw over the weekend a comment in relation to North Waziristan. And North Waziristan seems to be the centre of the Taliban, the Afghanistan Taliban within the Fatah areas within Pakistan. The US Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, who's always been an advocate for us giving Pakistan a go, said that he described North Waziristan as the epicentre of terrorism literally in the world. But he also said, he made the comment in the Wall Street Journal, that we should expect a military offensive on the terrorist haven in North Waziristan by Pakistan at some indeterminate time in the future. Now, he admitted he couldn't say when, but he's a guy that's been working Pakistan and working them and working them. The point I make is that Pakistan may change. If they does change, it will be a new game. If they don't change, it doesn't mean we're defeated. Next point, and I guess that could awfully just about be my last point, there is no military solution. That's what everyone tells us. There is no military solution. I've never met a soldier who contested that point. I've never met a soldier from 2004 onwards in Iraq and Afghanistan who ever said that there was. But a basic level of at least local security is absolutely essential for everything else that you're going to do. People can say, pull the military out and put civilians in. Great stuff, but you'll all be dead. I may have time for another one. We've not won in 9 years.
A couple of minutes.
Oh, okay, thanks, Russell. We've not won in 9 years, so why do you think we're going to win now? Well, that's a very good point, actually, because this, like the Iraq War, is a good 2-year war that's been transferred by sheer incompetence and under-resourcing into a 7.5-year war or a 9-year war. Anyone who says that we have tried everything in relation to assisting another country to overcome its insurgency over the last 9 years in Afghanistan hasn't really been looking at it. This has been grossly mismanaged. And the last American forces of the current surge, as I'm sure you all know, only arrived in Afghanistan in the last month. So for us to say we've been doing this for 12 months, it's just not true. This is a new phase of whatever this war is, however long you would like to consider that this war is gone. And the last one that I will go on to is that the commander on the ground has not asked for more resources. And that's it. That you're dead. That's the finish. When that statement is made, there is no discussion. Because the commander on the ground obviously knows absolutely everything. He's given his view to the Prime Minister, and that seems to end the debate quite dead. I was comforted yesterday when the Prime Minister said that she takes advice from the military, but she takes responsibility. Because certainly what I was seeing in relation to the commander on the ground, and there's a couple in the chain of command, and the CDF, was who all are honourable and competent people, but they're being asked the question in relation to an extraordinarily narrow task. Do you need more troops to impart skills and experience to the Afghan army? Probably not. Do you need more troops to make it meaningful in a Ruzgan? Well, that question hasn't been asked. And that's the question that's got to be asked. And we've got to follow it through. The military cannot even offer an independent view on this. They can't put their hand up and say to the press, well, we're doing this job very, very well, the narrow job the government wants us to do, but you know, I reckon we should be doing this job and it would take this amount of forces. It ain't going to happen, and neither it should happen. But the problem then is that if our leaders then rely on what the commander on the ground says to end the debate, then I think that's a sad thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I've just about flogged my time. I'm just about to go to Jeffrey's time. But I thank you very, very much. I've stated as quickly as I could the kind of big issue points and where I stand on those. And I've tried to take to bits a few of the general derailing points that come out of every discussion that I think I've ever had on Afghanistan. I'd be very happy to answer any questions that you'd like to ask during the Q&A period, particularly on tanks.
There's going to be a question on tanks. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have a second speaker, of course, and thank you, Jim, for your very lively, energetic and very thoughtful presentation. Those of you who have been in this building, occupants of this building for a long period of time, will surely have seen Geoffrey Barker in the building. He, of course, has now retired from his position as the Defence and Foreign Affairs correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. But, of course, Geoffrey is very important in the world of people who report foreign and defence matters from the Parliament, because unlike some people who engage in this kind of activity, who have been sent off to do this work by their editor, Geoff has made a lifelong study of foreign policy and defence and security issues. So he's an absolutely dedicated professional to the field. So most of his 40 years as a journalist, he has been writing on these issues. He's very familiar with them in the context, of course, of Australian security and Australian foreign policy. He may have retired for the moment, but as those of you who continue to read actively in this area will know, he continues to write articles from time to time for the Australian Financial Review. He is a visiting fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. He is also an author, like Jim has been. I think one of his books is called Sexing It Up, Australia, Iraq and Intelligence. He's obviously come to the Iraq experience from a rather different perspective than has Jim, but nevertheless provided a very stimulating account in relation to intelligence issues. He has a book which is awaiting publication in relation to the history of Australia's spy submarines. But in the meantime, he has been thinking about Afghanistan, and I'd be grateful if you would welcome him to the podium this afternoon for a different discussion.
Thanks, Russell, and thanks for coming to listen to me. It's a little daunting to find myself here questioning Australia's military deployment to Afghanistan when the nation's political leaders who disagree on just about everything else are in heated agreement in the parliamentary debate now underway in the House of Representatives. But it is reassuring to discover that while Jim and I have some different views, we agree about rather more than I thought we would. Of course, the views of one superannuated hack matter very little. But it surprises me that some people like yourselves, might take my views seriously enough to listen to them during your lunch break. Even more surprising to me is how seriously some journalists take themselves these days, blogging, tweeting, Facebooking and appearing together on television panel shows to tell each other and anyone who cares to watch what they think about any issue under the sun. That's what I call group narcissism, and I'll try not to succumb to it. I should start by declaring that I am a foreign and security policy realist of essentially Machiavellian and Hobbesian disposition. What matters is human nature and the management of power, not universal moral principles. I'm not opposed to sacrificing blood and treasure, to putting our forces in harm's way to preserve our national security where necessary. And I have four sons. One, a reserve army officer, of whom I am very proud. My essential problem with the Afghanistan mission that is not at all clear why we are there and what our plans are for leaving. It is not clear why we are putting our troops in harm's way when Afghanistan presents absolutely no threat to our national security, or, as former Army Chief General Peter Lay has put it, when there is no definitive link between Australia's national security interests and our presence in Afghanistan. The claim that we are preventing Afghanistan from again becoming a safe haven for terrorists lacks serious credibility. And as a realist, I think that in the absence of a credible threat, we should get out as soon as it is reasonably possible to do so. This talk expands on a column I wrote for the Financial Review on August 30 this year and includes some reflections on yesterday's speech by the Prime Minister and on views advanced by General Molan and others that we should expand. And the views advanced by General Molan and others that we should expand our deployment rather than quit the field and remove restrictions on the rules of engagement so that we might engage in a war of annihilation without regard to so-called collateral damage, that is, killing any women and children and civilians who get in the way. Let me begin by noting that after 10 years of fighting, the war in Afghanistan has proved unwinnable and is increasingly and pointlessly lethal. I note the recent words of US Commander General Petraeus, quote, "I don't think you win this war, I think you keep fighting. This is the kind of fight we're in for the rest of our lives and probably our kids' lives," unquote. Are we really fighting the first endless, unwinnable war in human history? I don't think so, but the possibility alone would most certainly prompt irresistible public demands for a withdrawal. A realist fights to prevail, to restore and maintain balance and order in an ultimately anarchic world, not to pursue some agenda such as improving educational opportunities for girls, as desirable as that objective might be. I note that Australian opinion polls already show that more Australians oppose the deployment to Afghanistan than support it. It is an unpopular war, and rightly so, and wise political leadership would not continue to defend Australia's role in it. We should also note that the Afghan government has proved irredeemably corrupt and incompetent and incapable of controlling much more than Kabul and some of its environs. Moreover, the war has little to do with countering jihadist terrorism. So little to do with countering jihadist terrorism that President Karzai has confirmed that talks have been continuing with the leaders of the Taliban insurgency for some time, with the view to bringing them into the beleaguered government. Now, if Karzai feels he has to negotiate with the Taliban and to co-opt them eventually into the government, the case for Allied forces continuing to fight them seems to be significantly undermined. Karzai has, in fact, run up the white flag. So what vital strategic Australian interests are at stake in Afghanistan? Australia initially went to Afghanistan for two powerful reasons: to help oust the Taliban regime that sheltered the Al-Qaeda jihadists behind the 2001 terrorist attacks on the US, and to demonstrate yet again, as it has demonstrated itself in the past, Australia's commitment to its alliance with the United States, its ultimate security guarantor. More recently, the Australian role in Afghanistan has emphasised training and mentoring the Afghan Army's 4th Brigade, a mission which is proving increasingly costly and lethal. Now, let me here offer four reasons why I reject the Prime Minister's claim that our mission is justified because it's helping to prevent Afghanistan from again becoming a safe haven for terrorists. One, Al-Qaeda now has other safe havens in Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan. It simply doesn't need Afghanistan. Two, this justification seems to me to smack of an implied argument for preventive or preemptive warfare, both difficult and dubious propositions. I've not thought this right through, but I think we should be very careful about going to war to stop something that might or might not happen again. Three, as it evolves, the threat from jihadist terrorism increasingly comes from homegrown extremists in Australia, the UK, the US and other democracies. That is a much more real and present threat that needs to be countered ahead of preventing any hypothetical and unlikely restoration of a safe terrorist haven in Afghanistan. Four, even if government policy succeeded in Afghanistan, whatever succeed might be, it would be naive to think that that vast and remote country would not still contain many who would proselytise for the jihadist ideology. They would hardly be stopped by the incompetent, corrupt government structures and security services likely to be established over time by the Western allies, and they would be assisted by the poorest border with Pakistan and Pakistani sympathisers. Like it or not, we cannot destroy these people. They can just wait us out however long it takes. Now, the following seems to me to be a reasonable assessment of the current state of affairs. The Taliban, initially ousted from power in Kabul, is back in force and mounting a nationwide insurgency. It has even set up a sort of shadow government in parts of the country. Osama bin Laden's jihadist Al-Qaeda organisation has not a significant influence, and there is no evidence that the Taliban wants to spread jihadist jihadism via terror throughout the world. To them, the various foreign forces are invading armies of occupation, not saviours bringing the blessings of freedom and democracy to a blighted nation. The aim of the insurgents is to drive the foreign forces from the country to regain control of their land. It is an anti-invader and perhaps a territorial or immature nationalistic imperative, not global jihadist ambition, that is driving the mosaic of ruthless and violent ethnic, tribal and language groups that make up Afghanistan and control the country outside the protected limits of Kabul. A powerful and primitive warrior culture pervades Afghanistan. It wants to impose its values and attitudes, and it is not hard for the warlords to find fighters prepared to engage the foreigners on a full-time or part-time basis. Now, it's well known that the Taliban fighters receive support, sustenance and sanctuary through the porous northern tribal border areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan. There seems little doubt that parts of the Pakistan military and intelligence establishments are assisting the insurgents, presumably because they sympathise with their aims and attitudes. There have been reports this week that Osama bin Laden and his deputy are living comfortably in northwest Pakistan, protected by Pakistani intelligence. Yet there are severe constraints on Allied attempts to deal with the border issues and to carry the war into Pakistan. Although the US is using unmanned drones to attack and destroy insurgents where they can, in some important respects, we seem to be fighting the wrong war in the wrong place. As last year's Defence White Paper noted, and I quote, any solution to the problems faced by Afghanistan will need to address the issue of insurgent safe havens located in Pakistan, unquote. Well, the issue isn't being addressed in any meaningful way, and Pakistan is treacherously walking both sides of the street, a matter conveniently ignored by the Prime Minister and opposition leader yesterday. Now, I believe the time has come for the large and growing Afghan army and police forces trained by the US and its allies, including Australia, to start to assume full-time frontline responsibility for defeating the insurgency, if that is what the Karzai government wants as it sets about its negotiations with the Taliban. Rates of desertion, self-harm and other forms of criminality might start to decline if the army and police were given that task. The Australian reported recently that Afghan army and police numbers now total about 134,000, while Taliban numbers are estimated to be somewhat above 13,000 full-time and part-time fighters. Seems to me that those numbers should give even the largely incompetent and unreliable Afghan forces a reasonable edge in the contest. I do not dispute that the Taliban are monsters, as are many of Karzai's crooked cronies, but they are Afghanistan's monsters, and it's up to the Afghanis to slay them or to submit to them. Foreign armies have failed to beat them despite heavy losses, huge troop surges and boasts of progress by American generals who have mastered media spin far more completely than they have mastered the insurgency. In fact, US military leaders in Afghanistan have rehearsed the timeless plea of generals, give us more heroes, more bullets, and we will prevail. Now their cry is, with the American surge complete, we now have the numbers and the material in place to get on top of this problem soon. Be of good cheer, be patient, and we will succeed. The faint Australian echo of all of this is the Prime Minister's bat squeak mantra yesterday, give us another 2 to 4 years and we'll get the job done, although we'll likely have to hang around for a decade. I think the best response to those claims is the lyric of a famous song of the Second World War. It seems to me I've heard that song before. It's from an old familiar score. And nobody quite knows what success in Afghanistan might look like anyway, what the job is really supposed to be. Now, despite airy claims that success is just around the corner, the US has announced plans to start withdrawing its troops from July next year. Britain too is talking about a 2011 withdrawal. Canadians are on their way out, the Dutch have gone. So the case for the open-ended deployment of Australia's 1550 soldiers or for sending more simply lacks credibility in these circumstances. It is time to start folding the tents because essentially we're not getting anywhere. For many, however, the issue of the US alliance still looms large. To use a Vietnam era phrase, we are putting ourselves on the line in the US putting ourselves on the line with the US is the premium we pay for the insurance policy as the US alliance. The opposition leader yesterday counseled us against appearing to be fair weather friends to the US. We have to be in Afghanistan and Iraq so that Uncle Sam will know us, love us, remember us and save us if we get into trouble that we can't handle ourselves. Now, I don't dispute the value of the US alliance. I assume it is invaluable at many levels, and that is our vital national interest to preserve it. But the US does not expect its allies to join all of its wars or risk being abandoned. If you will again indulge my banal musical tastes, I think Australia is like the young lady in Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, who sings, "I'm just a girl who can't say no." US allies don't have to say yes every time, any more than the US has said yes every time we wanted support. The British weren't in Vietnam. Canadian and European allies don't come running whenever Uncle Sam sounds the bugle. Australia's alliance record is impeccable. And now that the US is planning to leave, Canberra need not hesitate to start pulling out its forces. We can for once display a measure of independent judgment and decision making, especially since post-global financial crisis America is clearly acknowledging the limits of its capacity in Afghanistan. As President Obama said at West Point nearly 2 years ago, quote, "The nation that I'm most interested in building is our own." Australian leaders would do well to take a similar view. Now, some thoughtful military leaders, including General Lay, have argued that Australia should now give priority to increasing its civilian effort. Despite his concerns about the lack of a link between our national security interests and our presence in Afghanistan, General Lay believes the military deployment should be expected to continue for 4 years and that the civil aid program continue for considerably longer. I see difficulties here, difficulties that were illustrated in the recent kidnapping and killing of the Scottish aid worker Linda Norgrove. Aid workers are extremely vulnerable in a country like Afghanistan. If they are not protected by troops, they face mortal danger, and an increased civilian aid effort would probably require an expanded military protection effort, especially in the aftermath of Miss Norgrove's death. Perhaps we do have some moral responsibility to try to repair some of the damage inflicted by the war, but as General Lay acknowledges, and as General Mullen said today, if our objective in Afghanistan is a society resembling ours, forget it. We are unlikely to get a society free from corruption and violence with a fully representative government. So what should we settle for? No one seems clear, and that's another reason for getting out of the place. And let me finish on an historical point. I acknowledge General Molan's analysis of this here, but there is abundant evidence of the ability of Afghani warlords to defeat foreign invaders, quite apart from the British experience of the 19th century, which General Molan has talked about. Between 1979 and 1989, with US help, the Afghanis, the Mujahideen, drove out the Russians, killing at least 15,000 Soviet soldiers in the process. So far, some 2,000 coalition soldiers have died, and many more have been horribly maimed by the Taliban weapon of choice, the IED. Now, as my friend Paul Dibb has written, the Soviets and Americans started with limited, well-defined objectives in Afghanistan, but got drawn to what became a much longer and debilitating war than initially envisaged. I want to finish by leaving you to finish my final sentence, a sentence which I owe to George Santayana. Those who forget the lessons of history. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Jeff. As I say, not merely a journalist, but in fact an analyst of international politics and in particular Afghanistan. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have about 10 to 15 minutes for questions and comments, and I think the easiest thing to do is to direct your questions to either one or both of the panellists as seems appropriate. I'm not going to mediate, I think you can do this.
Much, General Mullen. The war in Afghanistan isn't the only one in the region. Russia's also had a war in Chechnya, which isn't that far away. Mm-hmm. And the Russians seem to have been fairly successful waging their war under the Kadyrov regimes in place. The Chechen jihad has been crushed. Are there any lessons we should be learning from the Russian army?
No. We saw this morning that Chechens are sticking their heads back up. I think there's a lot more to go in the Chechen struggle. Jeffrey quoted what the Russians did from 1979 until 88, I think. That probably, you know, in the annals of military history, probably the most immoral, probably the most violent and incompetently conducted military operation known to mankind. I don't think you can make any comparisons at all with what we are doing. 15,000 of them died. I have no idea how many tens, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Afghanis died. In the last year of war they prosecuted there, it was appalling. You know, carpet bombing buildings, carpet bombing village after village after village after village. Now, at the end of that year, towards the end of 88, just before they withdrew, they had pretty well suppressed Afghanistan. You'd have to really get a PhD in and figure out whether, in fact, they withdrew across that magnificent bridge because they were totally defeated in that country or because their country fell apart. And that's the balancing thing. On the moral, on the issue of morality, on the issue of tactics and techniques, there ain't one thing they can teach us.
Yep. General Mullen, when you talk about winning, what is it that you actually conceptualise?
I do it two ways. And yeah, I'll say win. A lot of people really get confused about the term winning. I look at it in two ways. We, the interventionist forces, win at a different level than those that win the war. When people say we can't win the war, you Westerners can't win the war, yeah, well, we're not trying to win the war. What we're trying to do as interventionist forces is conduct the basic function of interventionist forces as we did in Iraq. That is to create breathing space for the Afghans. Now, I don't have an emotional connection to Afghanistan as I do to Iraq. Maybe the time will come when we dump Iraq. If it ain't going bad, then we dump them. Afghanistan, I should say. We leave, and that's it. And we've got to be brutal. You've got to have that ability and be brutally honest about it. All these things that people are saying now about the interventionist forces were said in 2005 and 2006 in Iraq, and they were wrong. We didn't help, of course, because we didn't do that war particularly well. We win at the tactical level. That is, and this is the process. We fight the Taliban to the extent to convince them that they cannot win. It's not going very well. But now with the full troops in, we should, with a bit of luck, and that's all it comes down to, with a bit of luck, we may have the ability to convince the Taliban they cannot win. The consequence of which is they negotiate this. That's what happened to the Sunnis in Iraq. Now, that's what Petraeus has said, that's what Petraeus is operating, that's the basis on which he's operating. Everyone wants to talk to him. I've talked to him, but you don't. What you don't say is what I think our ex-foreign minister was saying yesterday, which is time to negotiate with the Taliban. Well, you set conditions, because if you don't set conditions when you negotiate with the Taliban, in fact, you're surrendering to them. And the conditions go something like, you've got to join the political process, you get none of the security ministries in a new government, you own no discrete parts of Iraq, and you give up your connection with Al-Qaeda. And what does that make the Taliban? Afghans. And therein, that's what the interventionist forces have got to set up so the Afghans can do.
Yes, Alan?
Thanks, Russ. Question to both Jim and Jeff. Several parts, but it goes to that question, I guess, of hearts and minds, and the issue of what are we dealing with in Afghanistan, and what's the capacity of a surge to be successful from a military perspective, but also the question of what do you need to do to actually deal with that hearts and minds issue. You probably saw, I think it was Four Corners, I saw it last night, which looked at the question of what occurred with the surge in Iraq, and which was basically saying the surge in itself hadn't been successful. What had been successful had been an engagement with the Iraqi, militias and rank and file personnel, that actually they were the ones that effectively had driven out the extremists to the degree that it's occurred in Iraq. So I'd be interested on that aspect of it, because one of the key questions here, I guess, is that question about how much are we fighting the Taliban and how much are we fighting proxies within the population, because there's an element of anti-interventionist sentiment And where do we? What's the line in the context of how we engage militarily to actually achieve military objectives, which will provide a secure environment, while at the same time not throwing the baby out with the bathwater? And I think that flows on to the question of, I think Jeff mentioned the issue of some of the stuff that Peter Lay has said around that question of beefing up the civilian component and using that as a way to actually deal with some of that anti-interventionist sentiment. So some broader questions there. And I think the other broader point which I've mentioned on the way through is that, if you like, Iraq and Afghanistan do have some very strong similarities in my view, but the similarities are also often in the terms of what we have done wrong and how we have prosecuted things badly. And I guess there's a question there about how do we look to the future, given the fact that I suspect this is not the last time we're going to be engaged in what has been, what has typically been the nature of warfare pretty much Vietnam onwards.
Yep.
This whole issue of winning hearts and minds, I seem to remember that from the beginning one day. We were going to sort of win the hearts and minds of the people by, you know, convincing them that we could, they could be turned into little liberal democracies like ours. And I don't think that's the only objective here, as Mr. Moles has said, but what you're dealing with in Afghanistan is this sort of small and pretty corrupt elite that runs the government, this national insurgency that has its own sort of agenda. I find the question, I don't quite understand what you really want to know.
How do we balance that question? I mean, the most compelling argument for me for getting out is that the mere fact that we're there is creating a large part of the armed struggle. Okay, that point. And so the argument being that if you moved out, and as my father used to say about, I'll give them all a gun and a shovel, what would happen? Now, the point in respect to that, therefore, is how do we balance that? I mentioned back to Vietnam because I think there are lessons which relate to that time, but I don't think they're also the same. I think the nature of what we're dealing with in both Iraq and in Afghanistan is quite different to in Vietnam in the context of what the forces were and the nature of their basis within those communities.
I don't agree with that. I haven't seen it before, but I've had it explained to me by a couple of people. And it goes to the argument, what came forth first, the negotiating or the surge? It doesn't matter. Petraeus was there negotiating with his colonels, talking to the Sunnis. He had relationships with the Sunnis. And what came really first was President Bush, God bless him, indicated resolve. Now, you don't have to have 130,000 troops on the ground, or the reinforcing, what was it, 30, an extra 30,000 troops having arrived and having been there, for the Taliban to say a couple of things. Firstly, well, maybe the Americans aren't going to go. First thing they say. Secondly, maybe these Al-Qaeda people who are killing us as regularly as they are killing Shias and Americans, who want us to be, as when we're doing, we're good Iraqi Sunnis, and we are, now we're being Sharia'd, and we're being killed, and it's an appalling situation. You know, who cares which came first? All of these things are going around. The end thing was that if you didn't have the resolve, maybe it wouldn't have happened. If you didn't have Al-Qaeda, which has in it the seeds of its own destruction, well, maybe the problem wouldn't have been there. All of these things go around. At the end, pops a view amongst the Sunnis that they cannot re-establish themselves as the primary people. Now, that to me is the big lesson. And how was that done? Well, there was a significant military component to it. A significant military component to it. Yeah, we might have got a lot of that wrong. We should have cracked that. I had a certain responsibility when I was there as Chief of Operations in 2004 for an aspect of Sunni engagement. We couldn't engage with the Sunnis because the Sunnis were convinced they were going to win. They reckon they had us on the ropes, and we weren't far off the ropes. Whilst the Taliban thinks it can win, it's not going to negotiate. It'll come to a table and talk to us, exactly as what happened at the end of the Vietnam War, But they're not going to compromise. We're compromising, left, right, and centre. But they're not going to compromise. They kill us, so we compromise. And people say, you can't have that as your strategy. Kill the Taliban, put them in jail so they learn they can't win, and they come and compromise and be good Afghans. Simplistic, but it's not rocket science. In relation to, and again, you can over-intellectualise the process of winning hearts and minds. Call it whatever you want. The first aspect is to create security. Nothing happens. You know, we've been through this 1 million times in every little part of Iraq and every little part of Afghanistan. You know, it's not just this poor woman NGO that was killed accidentally or otherwise by a rescuing force. What about those ophthalmologists, the eye doctors that up north, 8 of them who were executed on the spot? What about the fact that we won't send our Aussie people outside Tarrant Cow, outside the base, not even into the city of Tarrant, unless they're encased in metal? Peter Lake can say until the cows come home, we need more civilians over there, and you can go there, but I ain't, because you'll be dead. And that's it, you won't be able to operate. Sorry.
Yeah. I've got two others, gentlemen here, and then Mark Bishop.
General, you made much of the fact that providing breathing space for the Afghan government was the key thing in your view. And then we hear senior American general saying the government are nothing but a criminal cabal. It sounds like we're on a party to nothing here. And how does this affect the morale of soldiers who say, yeah, I want to create a space for the Afghan government, and then get told that the government's criminal?
I've got to say, I've never heard an American general in a responsible position in Afghanistan or the chain of command say that. I don't doubt that they may think it's correct, and it may even be correct. But we're not fighting for the Afghan government. The fact that they may be a group of criminal, corrupt people, just makes it that much harder. The question I've got is, what did anyone expect? What happened when Indonesia popped out of 28 years of Sukarno? You know, what happened when Russia popped out of 28 years of totalitarian government? Corruption goes whoop, criminality goes whoop. What did we expect? In Indonesia, it took us 3 lovely but relatively incompetent governments to get to what we've got now. Our soldiers don't think they're fighting for the Afghan government, they're fighting for their own commanders. But what is overwhelmingly important is that the soldiers must be assured directly or indirectly, in a subtle or direct way, that they are fighting for a moral cause. And the morality of the cause that we're fighting for must be in the forefront of every commander. From a certain rank up, it is overwhelmingly important.
Jeff? Mark?
Thank you, Chair, and thank both speakers for making themselves available today. Yesterday, in a committee, CDF addressed the issue of corruption at all levels within the Afghan society and community, and essentially defined it as a failure of governance and a failure of government until those two matters were addressed, expected to continue and just live with it. So be it, that may or may not be correct. In that context though, if corruption, as we define it, is a way of life in that country, how big an impediment is it to the limited military victory you in particular, General, have defined as possible? And do we just, in that context, if it's not a particular impediment to that limited military victory, what of it then, in the scheme of things?
Oh, I think we set the bar very... I take General Molan's point, but I think we've set the bar very low for Afghanistan governance. I mean, I think the Prime Minister yesterday kept referring to the huge problem and the uncertainty, but we sort of tend to downplay this. We're asking soldiers to go and take huge risks, you know, to defend people who really don't have the welfare of the people at the centre of their interests. They're about self-enrichment, often through the growth of poppies, I guess. you have, obviously we can't impose our values on them as much as we'd like to, or say our aim, but I can't see the point in continuing to say, well, these soldiers are not fighting for the Afghan government, they're not fighting for themselves, they're fighting for their commanders, they're just trying to create a bit of breathing space. If the end game is just to entrench these sort of people in control of the place, especially when the government itself, as I tried to point out, is already, dealing in various ways with the Taliban, and the Taliban has taken advantage of this by setting up its own sorts of, I call it a shadow government. They have even ombudsmen, and they manage to, one way or another, use their coercive and other powers to get people to submit to their will or their judgment and rule in various places. I don't see. I don't see why we have to set the bar so low. I mean, we ought to be insisting, among other things, that Karzai's people, seems to be clean up their act a great deal before we continue to support them. If they won't, I can't see the point in continuing to defend them and to preserve their rule. You might as well let the place go to hell. The fetish view, I know, but I can only despair at those people who are in that country.
Very quickly, I wouldn't mind allowing Afghanistan to go to hell if there were no consequences. I can't say there would definitely be consequences of allowing the country to go to bits, but there is a possibility there will be consequences. Whatever we do, the good we do, the bad we do, the effect we achieve, are for our own purposes. But they benefit others. At a certain stage, we chop it. I don't think we're anything. It doesn't surprise me. I started my military career in Papua New Guinea. I went to Indonesia. I went to East Timor. I found myself in Iraq, and we're now looking at Afghanistan. they're pretty corrupt governments, all of them. We're just lucky.
We've passed the time, ladies and gentlemen, but there's one more question, and perhaps we'll just take that, and then some of you will have to go, I realise, but perhaps we just have this one question, and then we'll finish.
Thank you. I was listening to a very well-renowned ANU academic the other day discuss this self-same question on the issue of talking to the Taliban, and he said, this terrifies the Afghans. They are terrified that they might be included in any form of government. And he then went on to say that any deal with the Taliban simply won't stick. They don't adhere to international norms. And what we really need to do is confront Pakistan. I'm paraphrasing what he actually said, but confront Pakistan. I'd be interested to hear your views on those two statements.
What you've just described me is that we find a difficult problem, which is managing Taliban coming to the negotiating table. We're going to reject that problem, and we're going to take on an enormous problem. That doesn't make sense. And there's no point in negotiating with the Taliban now because they're tough guys. They think they're going to win. So by all means, talk to them and keep the talk going. But when you finally come to an agreement, the agreement's got to have the conditions I spoke about before. And then if they break the conditions, you boot them out.
Well, I just add, if the Taliban won't stick to any deal, if they don't observe international norms, the whole business of talking with them is pointless anyway, surely. And I agree that General Mullen agrees too, and I do, that one of the things we agree on is that the main game is in Pakistan. We are just avoiding that because it's so damn difficult. But I tend to agree with that. If we could resolve that problem, a lot of the problems that are being faced now would seem a lot less insurmountable.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to finish because we're past our time. I know we all have things to do, but may I just conclude the the seminar by thanking our speakers for coming and giving their time, and thank you for coming. This is obviously a challenging issue. We've had some points of agreement between our two speakers. They've both no doubt come from this, what the academics would call a realist perspective. So it's interesting that they come from a similar kind of philosophical position, but they have rather different perspectives on the issue. But it's been a lively seminar, an interesting one. I think we're all better informed about this topic, which of course is the purpose of these seminars. And I'd be grateful if you would join with me in thanking our speakers for coming. So.
It is very difficult to do this in the sitting day. If someone wants to say to me, sometimes I have a Vegemite on toast, you know, I have to eat all day.
It's good if you diet.
You've got to keep your energy levels up.
You're trying to keep
nourished. Probably took about 2 months if you traveled down here. And this sort of topic, if you can pick one in the week that can actually be that far, is really useful.
And the thing is,
yes, very important.
The Senate, of course, is the
There is a sort of interrupt.